Today is Sunday, October the 6th, 2019. Now, I'd like to ask each of you, and really to see if there is anyone here, what is going to happen tomorrow, Monday, October 7th, 2019? What's going to happen tomorrow? As we watch the news tomorrow, the 6 o'clock news, I don't know if any watch the 6 o'clock, any of you reach or watch the 6 o'clock news, but what's going to be the headline for the 6 o'clock news? As you open up the newspaper, what's going to be the main headlines for tomorrow, October the 7th, 2019? And we don't know the answer to that, do we? I don't think there are any of us, in fact, I know that there are none of us in this building that can infallibly declare the major events of tomorrow. Would you agree with that? Nobody here can infallibly predict the events of tomorrow. And really, we shouldn't feel bad because there's no one in this state, there's no one in this country, there's no one in the world that can infallibly predict the future. That's the way it is. So if nobody can predict the events of tomorrow, who can predict the events of 200 years from now? So if I would ask you what's going to happen October the 6th, 2219, who can tell me what's going to happen? None of us have that ability. Now, I don't know if any of you like to read, but science fiction writers, they write novels about what's going to happen in the future, whether it's just a few years in the future or whether it's hundreds of years in the future. And sometimes they're pretty close to what reality turns out. But not even the best science fiction writer is able to foretell the events with perfect accuracy. The only one who is able to infallibly declare the future is whom? It's God, isn't it? God is the only one who's able to do that. He's the one that plans the events of the future. He's the one that brings those plans into reality. He alone is the creator and the sustainer of the universe. He alone is all-powerful and all-wise. He is completely sovereign. He's in control. God is a God who can declare the events of the future just as well as he can declare the events of the past and the present. God is not a God who is limited by time. God operates above time. God is the Lord of time. Yes, he chooses to be active in time, but he's not limited by time. The prophet Isaiah communicated this truth so well in Isaiah 46. We read this in verses 9 through 11. I mentioned this before as we've considered the book of Daniel. God says, "Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure." Then he says a little bit later on in verse 11, "Truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, surely I will do it." That's the words of our great God. And God is the only one that can declare the end from the beginning. It poses no difficulty at all for God to foretell the events of tomorrow or next year or 200 years in the future. That poses no difficulty at all for God. God can even foretell the events of what's going to happen thousands of years from now. Now, thankfully, as we read through the pages of Scripture, we're able to read many of the things that God has foretold, many of the prophecies that he has revealed to prophets of old. And there are many of the events that have been prophesied in the past that have come to pass just as God has said they would. There are a number of events that still remain to be fulfilled in the future. And God is going to fulfill those events just as he said he would fulfill them. I invite you this morning to turn with me in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 11. We'll be looking, Lord willing, at verses 2 through 35. If you're using one of our pew Bibles, it's page 1034. So as we consider the background of this incredible prophecy of Daniel chapter 11 and even going into chapter 12, we read in chapter 10 of Daniel, Daniel tells us when these things occurred. He says that they happened the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. And as we consider our modern reckoning of dates, this would be the date of 536 BC. This is when Daniel received this revelation from the Lord, from a holy angel of God. It was during this time that Daniel was giving himself to mourning and prayer. He was concerned for his people of Israel. 3 weeks Daniel sought God's face. He didn't eat his normal food. He just had probably bread and water. He wore sackcloth, I believe, and he had ashes upon his head. He was mourning for his people Israel. He was seeking God's face concerning what laid in the future for them. Now, an angel came to Daniel after these 3 weeks, and this angel had an important message from God to him. Yes, Daniel was very overwhelmed as he saw this angel in all of his glory. He was greatly weakened as he was as he encountered this very powerful supernatural being. And time again, the angel strengthened him so that he could receive the prophecy and understand the prophecy. And this prophecy that the angel gave him, it was so important that for 3 weeks, those 3 weeks of Daniel's mourning, there was angelic warfare. There was this good angel wanting to bring this message to Daniel, but opposing him was an evil angel. The prince of Persia is what we read about in Daniel 10, but it's no ordinary prince. This is an evil angel opposing the good angel that is coming to Daniel. This is a very important message that the angel brings to Daniel concerning the future of his people. Now, what is this prophecy that was so important that angels even warred over it for 3 weeks? Well, our passage begins this morning in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 2. This is the holy angel of God speaking to Daniel. And he says, "And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet 3 kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up against the realm of Grisha." What is the very first thing that the angel tells Daniel? He begins by saying, "I am telling you the truth. I'm going to tell you the truth." So the words that you hear from me, these are words of truth. These are words that come from God. This can be trusted. What you hear me speak will indeed come to pass. Now, at the time that Daniel received this prophecy, Cyrus was the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. The date, as I mentioned earlier, was 536 BC. And in the years to come, there would be 3 more kings that would be ruling over the Medo-Persian Empire. And after these 3, there would be a 4th that even distinguished himself from the prior 3. Now, these 3 kings of which the angel speaks are these. Now, keeping in mind, Daniel, when he received this revelation, none of this had occurred yet. But we live centuries, even millennia after Daniel received this revelation. And so we don't look to the future, we look to the past, because this is fulfilled history now. The angel said there's going to be 3 kings yet to come. As we look back into history, these 3 kings are Cambyses. He ruled from 529 to 522 BC. After him was Pseudo-Smerdis. He ruled from 522 to 521 BC. And then there was Darius Hystaspes. He ruled from 521 to 468 BC. Now, the angel told Daniel there's going to be a 4th king that he's going to be distinguishing himself from the rest. This king is Xerxes I. He reigned from 486 to 465 BC. This is the same king that we read about in the book of Esther. In Esther, he's known as Ahasuerus. Now, Xerxes was a very wealthy king. He accumulated great wealth. He over a 4-year period, formed a very large army. And the purpose of building this very large army, he wanted to invade the country of Greece. And he did invade it, but he met a very great defeat as he tried to invade Greece. His invasion was a failure. And it was this invasion of Greece by Xerxes that motivated a man named Alexander the Great to attack Medo-Persia almost 150 years later. And it's this king that we read about in verses 3 and 4. "And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the 4 winds of heaven, not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those." Now, as I mentioned earlier, the mighty king of verse 3 is Alexander the Great. He began his conquest of the Medo-Persian Empire in the date of 334 BC. And within a relatively short period of time, Alexander the Great had defeated all of Medo-Persia. He had the domination of them. And in just a matter of years, Alexander not only conquered the Medo-Persian Empire, but he conquered a large swath of territory covering 11,000 miles. It's incredible. Now, Alexander was a very great king. He was a mighty king. He had a very great dominion, but his dominance did not last very long. At the age of 32 years, in 323, he died. Upon his death, neither of his sons received the kingdom. Actually, both of his sons were murdered. And his great kingdom was divided into four. Four generals took various parts of his kingdom. Now, of the four divisions of Alexander's empire, there were two that were especially significant, especially as we consider Israel. Remember, the angel is telling Daniel, this is what's going to happen in the future, and what happens in the future is going to affect your people, the Jewish people. So two of these kingdoms, remember, Alexander the Great had this great Grecian empire. After his death, it was divided into four. Two of the divided portions were especially important. We have the kingdom of the south, and we have a map here I will show you. So here is how the Greek empire of Alexander the Great, it was divided up into four. So we have this area of Egypt and surrounding territory. This would be known as the kingdom of the south. It was ruled by the Ptolemies, and it was known as the kingdom of the south because it is located to the south of Israel. We also have the kingdom of the north. It was centered in Syria. And so we have the circle around the area of Syria. And it turned out to be a very large kingdom. But this kingdom of the north was centered in Syria. It was ruled by the Seleucids. And because Syria was north of Israel, it was known as the kingdom of the north. And for years, these two kingdoms fought against each other. The kingdom of the north against the kingdom of the south. The kingdom of the south against the kingdom of the north. And do you know what's right in the middle of the kingdom of the north and the kingdom of the south as you look at the map? What's right in the middle? You have Israel, you have Jerusalem, you have the Jewish people who have resettled in that land upon the declaration of King Cyrus. You have the Jewish people centered right there between these two opposing forces that are going one against the other. And at times, Israel, the Jewish people, was part of the domain of the king of the south. Part of the times it was part of the domain of the king of the north. So for years and years, these two kingdoms are fighting against each other. For a time, the kingdom of the south had domination over the kingdom of the north. For a time, even later on, the kingdom of the north had the domination. So first of all, let's consider verses 5 through 12, where the Jewish people were under the control of the king of the south. Now, keep in mind as we work our way through these verses, all of this was still future in Daniel's day. We today are looking at this as past history, but it's more than just history. We want to look at it from Daniel's perspective. God is foretelling through his holy angel what's going to happen in the future. This was years before, years in the future for Daniel. Now, because we live so long after Daniel, we're looking at this as fulfilled prophecy, events that have taken place in history. Now, I don't know how much you like history. You know, for many of us, we may not be all that fond of history. And as we work our way through these verses, I'm going to be talking about a lot of different people, I'm going to be telling you a lot of different dates and what happens. But keep in mind, even though a lot of these verses, they aren't going to mean a whole lot to us probably, we might get a little bit confused with all the names and the dates, but keep in mind, God declared to Daniel years before what would happen in the future, very detailed. And you know what? All of the details of that prophecy occurred just as the angel told Daniel. As we step back from this chapter, you know, and at the very end, you know, we might be kind of overwhelmed with the enormity of this prophecy and all of the history that we look at. But through all of this, we need to keep in mind our God is a great God. Our God is able to foretell the future because he is in control of the future. He is able to tell when kings rise and when kings fall and what's going to happen in those kingdoms. And God chose to reveal to Daniel what happens in the future. And he told him these things because this has a huge impact on his people, the people of Israel. So for us, this may seem like a confusing mass of names and dates that really impact us very little today. But let us keep in mind all of these details predicted years before they were fulfilled And God is a God who is a God of power and wisdom, a sovereign God in control of all of human history, past, present, future. So there's no other so-called gods that could make a proclamation like we read in Daniel chapter 11. There's no man on earth that could declare what's going to happen hundreds of years into the future with such 100% accuracy. God is the only one that can do this. And so throughout these verses, let us stand in awe of our great God who revealed the future to Daniel. So let's look at verse 5. What's going to happen in the future? Well, we have in verse 5, the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Now, Daniel, looking to the future, he didn't know how all this was going to happen. He just knew that this is what the angel told him. He didn't know all the details surrounding it. But for us looking back, we can study history and compare it with this prophecy, and we realize that the king of the south in this verse is Ptolemy the First Soter. He ruled from 323 to 285 BC. This king was a very powerful ruler. And during the time of his dominance, he had a military commander. His name was Seleucus the First Nicator. Now, Seleucus helped Ptolemy win some victories. And over the course of time, Seleucus took a position of authority, and he was ruling over a satrapy. And eventually, he would be coronated king. And he would rule over a much larger kingdom than Ptolemy. Seleucus would be the first of many who would be known as the king of the north. He would rule a kingdom that is centered in Syria. And you look at the green area on the map, you see how the green area is so much larger than the purple area, the purple area, which is the area domineered by the king of the south. And eventually, and keep in mind, throughout the years of history, their territory was in flux. As they conquered and then they were conquered, or they had victories and then they experienced defeats. So we continue reading in verse 6. And in the end of the years, they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. So looking ahead some years later, we have two different kings. We have Ptolemy the First Philadelphus. He reigned from 285 to 246 BC. He's from Egypt, that kingdom surrounded or centered in Egypt. We have Antiochus the Second Theos. He's from Syria. The two of them formed an alliance. The daughter of Ptolemy, her name was Bernice. So Ptolemy's daughter, Bernice. Keep in mind, Ptolemy was the king of the south. Ptolemy made an alliance with the king of the north, and Ptolemy's daughter Bernice was given in marriage to Antiochus, the king of the north, to bind together the alliance. Now, history, and keeping in mind this is prophecy, this is what's going to happen in the future, but in order to marry Bernice, Antiochus was forced to divorce his current wife, Laetus. Later on, Antiochus put away Bernice, and then took back his former wife, Laetus. But then Laetus, now keep in mind, if you were in this situation, if you were Laetus and you got divorced for another woman so that a treaty could be joined together, and then your former husband eventually put away that second wife and took you back as his wife again, how would you feel? Well, Laetus was not pleased with the whole situation. She was quite bitter. And so what did she do? She had Antiochus and Bernice murdered, along with Bernice's baby and those who had come along with her from Egypt. It was during this time that Ptolemy also died. Okay, so this is all prophecy given to Daniel, and we can look back and see how it's fulfilled. We stand in awe of our great God. Verses 7 through 9 now. But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north and shall deal against them and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods, with their princes and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. So we remember what happened to Bernice. What happened to Bernice? Bernice was murdered, right, by Laetus. Now Bernice's brother, Ptolemy III Euergetes, He became king. He reigned from 246 to 221 BC. He was the next king of the south. He reigned there in Egypt. To avenge his sister Bernice's death, what did he do? He invaded Syria. He killed Laodice. He conquered some of the Seleucids' territory. He carried some 40,000 talents of silver and 2,500 idols back to Egypt. Now, eventually, there was a king of the north, Seleucus Callinicus. He would rally an army against the Ptolemies. He would invade Egypt around 240 BC. He was defeated, though, and he had to return to Syria. Now, as we come to verse 10, the angel continues to give Daniel detailed prophecy about the years ahead. Now, I realize some of this might be a little bit difficult for us to process. And it's just, for you, maybe it's just a lot of names and dates, and it is a lot of names and dates. But let us stand in awe of our great God, who gave this wonderful, amazing, incredible prophecy to Daniel years before any of this came to pass. And we, looking back, can see how the things that were proclaimed years before to Daniel, we can look verse by verse by verse. These all were fulfilled as God said. God is a God who keeps his word. This is the overall big picture. We're going to see verse after verse after verse. Prophecy given to Daniel years before the fact, we looking back, each verse was fulfilled according to what God said. God is a God who keeps his word. We can trust him. So verse 10, but his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. Now there are two sons of Seleucus Callinicus. We have Seleucus the third, Saranus, and Antiochus the third, the great. They formed a great big army, a large army. It was a very formidable force, and each of them commanded a portion of that army. Now Seleucus was killed very early on in his military exploits. So now we have Antiochus. He is the notable leader of this large army of the Syrians. And he retook Syrian territory that had formerly been taken by the Ptolemies, their arch enemies. And by 219, he had taken even parts of Israel. In 217 BC, we have Antiochus leading his army all the way down to the Egyptian fortress at Raphia. He took it in battle. The current king of the south at that time was Ptolemy the IV Philopater, and he did nothing to fend off the attack. He was just kind of living up to life. He was enjoying the luxury so much he wasn't wanting to defend his territory until we come to verses 11 and 12. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. So eventually, Ptolemy, this king of the south, whose much of his territory had been taken by the king of the north, eventually he got angry because the king of the north was invading his territory and taking a lot of his territory. So Ptolemy eventually did get angry. So he gathered an army of 70,000 infantry. There were 5,000 cavalry. And then he also had 73 elephants. Now to us we think, well, elephants, that's something I see at the zoo. Back in those days, elephants were used in war, and they were a formidable force, especially if you have that many going against an enemy. Now his enemy had 72,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 102 elephants. Now in 217 BC, they warred at Raphia, and Ptolemy of Egypt won. But instead of going on and gaining more territory, he returned home to his life of luxury. Now, beginning with verse 13 down through verse 35, the angel foretells to Daniel where there will be a time of Seleucid dominance over the Ptolemies. So the king of the north now is going to have the dominance over the king of the south. And the Jewish people are also going to fall under the Syrian dominance, under the dominance of the king of the north. So let's look at verse 13 and 14. For the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. The year now is 203 BC. We have Ptolemy Philopater and his wife. They've already died. The successor to the kingdom was Ptolemy V Epiphanes. He took the reign of the kingdom at the age of 4 years old. Now, Antiochus the Great, the king of the north, saw a great opportunity now to invade the king of the south, to come against this child king of Egypt. And along with him, he had some allies. We have Philip V of Macedonia. We have some Egyptian rebels, as well as we have some Jewish men that wanted to overthrow the Ptolemies' control of their land. Now, these people were successful, this alliance. Syria had the victory. Now, Israel was under the control of the king of the north instead of the king of the south. The Jewish rebels, as they were helping the king of the north, though they may not have realized it, they played a part in the fulfillment of the vision given to Daniel. And years later, as we think about Israel now being under the dominance of the king of the north, years later, as we'll even see in this revelation, there will be a notable king of the north, known as Antiochus Epiphanes, that will do Israel great harm. We come to verse 15 now. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. So the fighting continues between the north and the south. 198 BC, Antiochus the Great conquers the forces of the Egyptian general Scopas. He besieges the city of Sidon, and three times the forces of Egypt try to break the siege, but three times they fail. Verse 16, but he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. Antiochus consolidated his control over Israel. He had no enemy opposition at this time, and Israel was treated well by Antiochus. He released them from taxes for a period of 3 years. He sent money to the temple. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter the strength of, with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. Let's pause and take a breath here. Why are we looking at all these verses? Wouldn't it be so much easier just to preach on the first part of Daniel? You know, what's the first part of Daniel? You know, we read about how Daniel and his friends, they refused to eat the meat, the food that the king had set before them, right? That was Daniel chapter 1. They wanted to eat instead of water and vegetables. And God blessed them for their obedience to him, and they were better off than any of the other captives of the land. You think about Daniel in the lion's den, right? That's an incredible story. You think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were thrown into the burning fiery furnace because they would not bow down before Nebuchadnezzar's image that he had set up. You know, those are incredible chapters. Why not just skip these last chapters of Daniel, these chapters of detailed prophecy, you know, because they don't interest us so much. Well, why are we going through these verses? Because our God is a great God. Our God in great detail told Daniel what would happen in the centuries ahead. And us looking back can see time and time again, according to each verse, God did what he said he would do. Is our God a faithful God? And the answer is yes, he's a very faithful God. And looking at this chapter, we see God is a God who keeps his word. We can trust him. So we look at verse 17 now. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. Antiochus, the king of the north, decided that at this point in time, another invasion of Egypt, the king of the south, would not be the best action, so he decided to make a treaty with them. As part of the treaty, the king of the north gave his daughter, you know what his daughter's name is? Cleopatra. Does that name sound familiar? He gave his daughter Cleopatra to the Egyptian king Ptolemy Epiphanes. That happened in 197 BC. At the time, Ptolemy Epiphanes was only 10 years old at the time. Antiochus's plan, the king of the north, his plan was, in making this alliance and in sending my daughter to be the wife of the king of Egypt, maybe I can hold some influence through my daughter over my enemy, the king of the south. Do you see how that works? Well, what happened? his daughter Cleopatra, instead of siding with her father, the king of the north, sided with her husband, the king of the south. Verse 18, after this shall he turn his face to the isles, and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon himself. In 197 BC, we have Antiochus, the king of the north, conquering some islands in the Aegean Sea. He took portions of Asia Minor, Thrace and Greece. He boasted against Rome that he had taken this territory, and Rome in turn sent a general against him, and we have a battle that erupted there, and Lucius Cornelius Scipio defeated Antiochus at the Battle of Magnesia. In 188 BC, Rome forced Antiochus to hand over all of Asia Minor, and now Rome was the one boasting against Antiochus. Verse 19, then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So instead of gaining more territory, Antiochus now is remaining in home territory in Syria. He was killed in 187 BC as he attempted to loot the treasures of a temple in Elam. And he tried to loot that temple because Rome, whenever they defeated him, put a high amount of money that they had to pay to them each year. And so the king of the north, his treasuries were empty, so he thought, I need money, I'm going to loot this temple so that I can refill my coffers. But he died in the process. Verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. After the death of Antiochus, his son Seleucus the IV Philippeter, he took the kingdom, and Rome required him to pay 1,000 talents of years, 1,000 talents each year in tribute. So what had been put on his father, now he had to pay. And to pay this, he raised the taxes on his people in Syria. He even intended to go to Jerusalem and loot the treasures of the temple. In 176 BC, he suddenly died. Perhaps he was poisoned. We come to verse 21. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Seleucus has now died. A man named Antiochus IV Epiphanes takes his place. Now, he is not the rightful heir. Seleucus had two sons that should have taken his place, but that's not how it worked. Antiochus gained control through flattery, through intrigue. Now, a lot of people did not think highly of Antiochus. Now, Antiochus called himself Theos Epiphanes. That means God made manifest. That's what Antiochus called himself. But those who did not like Antiochus called him Epimenes, or the madman. And he truly was a madman. Verse 22, and with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. In the early days of Antiochus's reign, we have the king of Egypt bringing an army against him. And Antiochus met them. He defeated them in 170 BC. And during this time, he allowed the high priest in Jerusalem, who at that time was Onias III, he was deposed by his brother Jason. So Antiochus allowed that to happen, for Onias to be deposed by Jason. Now, as high priest, Onias would be known as the prince of the covenant. He was the one who was to ensure that Israel followed the law. He was in that position to try to do his best to make sure Israel followed God and followed the law. But when Onias was taken off the scene, Jason was put in his place. And Jason got that place because of bribery. And Jason wanted Greek culture to be prominent in Israel as opposed to the law of God. So you can see how Jason was not a good high priest. Verse 23, and after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with the small people. Antiochus used deceit, and he used intrigue to gain control over his enemies in Egypt. He had a kingdom with just a small amount of territory, but he was able to become stronger and stronger through his deceitful means. Verse 24, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. Antiochus was a man who took riches from the wealthiest people in his kingdom, and then he distributed them to the poorer people of the kingdom. So, in a way, It was really socialism at play there in Antiochus' kingdom. And he did this to gain the support of the mass of the people. And he also wanted to take some fortresses in Egypt, but that didn't materialize. So let's take another little pause here. Why are we looking at all these verses in detail? Because God revealed his will and his plan for the future to Daniel, even years before it happened. As we look back in the past, we can see God faithfully doing as he has said. So can we trust God? The answer is yes. Time and time again, each verse here is showing the hand of God at work. Our God is sovereign and he's in control. So just as he was in control in telling Daniel what would happen in the future, he's just as in control today. And the promises he has given us today concerning the future, we can rely on them. We know God is sovereign. He is in control. He's the Lord of heaven and earth. He's the Lord of time. Verses 25 through 27. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Antiochus, the king of the north, now wants to invade Egypt, the king of the south. And Antiochus invaded Egyptian territory. He was met by the army of Ptolemy the sixth Philometor. And Ptolemy was defeated when some of his own men turned against him. So there was treason within the ranks. Some of his own men turned against him and aided the enemy, the Syrians. Ptolemy was taken captive. His brother Ptolemy the seventh, Euergetes, was made king in Egypt. Now Antiochus befriended the captive Ptolemy, and he wanted to gain control of Egypt. He was telling Ptolemy, this one who was captive, and now his brother was reigning in Egypt, he wanted to gain influence with the captive Ptolemy, and he told Ptolemy, if you help me and we win the victory over Egypt, then I'll put you in there as king again. And Ptolemy agreed because he's thinking, well, if I get placed as king, well, then maybe I can rebel against Antiochus and I can have all the power for myself. Now, Antiochus, whenever he came against Egypt, there was a measure of victory. He didn't defeat the whole region. He defeated a portion of the region. And so Ptolemy was made king in the city of Memphis, while his brother still had control in Alexandria. So there's a split kingdom right now as far as the kingdom of the south. And really, the one king is almost a puppet of the other. And so the reason why the scheming did not work, what do we read at the end of verse 27? For yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Who is the time? Who is the one that appoints the time? It's God who appoints the time. So things prosper or they don't prosper according to God's perfect timetable. Verse 28. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Antiochus returns to Syria. He has a lot of wealth gained from plunder of Egypt. And even before this war, Antiochus had removed Jason as high priest in Jerusalem. He had appointed Menelaus as high priest. But during Antiochus' campaign against Egypt, we have Jason, who hears a rumor that Antiochus had been killed. And so he tries to remove Menelaus as being high priest. And so there's this warfare or this fighting going on in Jerusalem. And so when Antiochus returns to Syria from Egypt, he comes against Jerusalem. He kills many of the Jews. He sells many of them into slavery. He takes treasure from the temple in Jerusalem. Antiochus showed great disregard for the God of the Bible, the God of the covenant, the people of Israel. He showed great disregard for the people of Israel. Verses 29 and 30. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter, for the ships of Kittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return, and have indignation against the holy covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. The date now is 168 BC. Antiochus again invades Egypt. The reason why he invades Egypt is because of the coalition of the two brothers. Remember the two brothers, one reigned in Memphis and one reigned in Alexandria. Now they had formed a coalition. So now the king of the north is coming against the Ptolemies, the king of the south. And this time Antiochus did not have a great victory. And the reason why is because the Romans, who were becoming a very great force to be reckoned with, the Romans did not want Antiochus to take Egypt. So they sent ships to make sure that Antiochus was not successful. Antiochus was told by the Roman general, leave the country. And if I remember correctly, that Roman general drew a circle around Antiochus, a circle in the sand, and he says, before you leave this circle, you have to decide, are you going to leave the country, or are you going to have war with Rome? Well, Antiochus was humiliated, he backed down, he went back home. Understandably, Antiochus was not very happy, he was quite angry, and so on his return home to Syria, he came against the Jews in Israel. He took action against them. In his mind, he wanted Israel to be Hellenized. He wanted them to live like Greeks. And we have the high priest Manilius. Antiochus treated him well because Manilius was in favor of Antiochus's plan to make the Jews live according to the pagan Greek ways. Verse 31, an arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. So Antiochus went against Israel and the Jews, and he left one of his generals with a great number of troops to keep the people in Jerusalem and in Israel from observing their Jewish practices. Instead, they were forced to live as pagan Greeks. So the sacrifices were stopped in the temple. Instead of sacrifices to the true and the living God, there was a pagan altar placed in the temple. The temple itself was dedicated to the Greek god Zeus. There were immoral heathen rites performed in the temple. All of these things were done, and so the temple was made an abomination because of the idolatry and the pagan practices that were occurring in it. Anyone who was determined to keep the law, whether it was observing the Sabbath or circumcising their sons or offering sacrifices to the true God, the decree was put them to death. Antiochus wanted to stamp out the true religion of worshiping God and instead wanted to elevate idolatry and the worship of Zeus and the other gods of the Greek pantheon. Verse 32, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupted, but shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Manilius, the wicked high priest, this one who was in favor of adopting Greek culture for the Jews, this one became even more corrupt. So instead of remaining a high priest to the true and living God, he became a priest of Zeus, according to what I understand by a commentary that I read. He didn't remain true to the living God. Those who did remain true to the God, to the true God, they were strong in their commitment to him. Verse 33, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by spoil many days. Now during this time, we have a priest named Mattathias Maccabeus. His five sons also with him. They understood that Antiochus was not leading the nation in the right way. They remained true to God, and they were committed to him. So Mattathias refused to offer a pagan sacrifice. He ended up killing the man who ordered him to make that pagan sacrifice. He and his sons fled to the mountains. And this is the beginning of what is known as the Maccabean Revolt. And many of those who revolted against Antiochus, they were killed and they were oppressed in other ways. Now, I don't know Mattathias' heart. I don't know if he was truly trusting in God or not. But he did stand up for the God of the Bible. He stood up for the law, God's instructions for his people Israel. Now when they shall fall, they shall be hoping with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. Now the Maccabees suffered a lot of losses, but they also had their victories. And during these times of victory, whenever they had dominance over an area of Israel, they had people joining them, not because these people were necessarily loyal to them, but the Maccabees were very harsh on those who were adopting Greek culture. Many times they would put to death those who were adopting Greek culture. So a lot of people were joining to them, not because they were loyal to the gods, but because they didn't want to be put to death. Verse 35, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge, and to make them white even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. We have Mattathias and his five sons. Some of his sons are killed in the revolt against Antiochus. Many who followed Mattathias and his sons were also killed. But yet God used this time as a purifying process. During this time of revolt against Antiochus, even in the future, God uses persecution and hardship to purify his people. And this is going to happen even until God's appointed end. We've covered a lot of verses. The reason why I covered them in such a fashion is because these are important verses. The God of the Bible is a God who is in control of all things. He is able to declare the future even though it has not yet happened. And all that he declared to Daniel that we looked at in these verses occurred just as he said it would occur. Now this holy angel of God that proclaimed this message to Daniel, he gave Daniel a very detailed picture of future events. He told events that would happen in Medo-Persia, as well as in the Grecian Empire, and especially he focused on the king of the south and the king of the north. Why? Because Israel and the Jewish people were right between them, and they were very much affected by what happened. And especially Daniel focused on the king of the north and one of the kings of the north, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, because it was through this man that great atrocities were done to the Jewish people. And this man, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, as terrible as he was, he foreshadowed somebody even worse, though we'll read about later on in chapter 11, the man we know as the Antichrist. And one day, the Antichrist is going to be revealed on this earth. The Antichrist has not yet been revealed today. And so, we worked our way through these verses. Maybe the things that we've covered seem to be rather involved and complex. But let us look at the big picture. Our God is a God who is powerful. Our God is a God who is sovereign. He is the God who declares the end from the beginning. Much of what he has declared in ages past has come to pass. What he has declared for the future yet will come to pass. Even as Isaiah said so long ago, "Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things which have not been, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure." This is the God that we serve. This is the God who does what he says he will do. He is the God of the past, the present, and the future. He has a perfect plan, and he's going to fulfill that plan just as he wishes. So this morning, let's exalt our God. Let's worship him. There's no one else like him. He is the sovereign Lord.